This episode was brought to you by Audible.com. You can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and sign up for a 1-month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal, and you support this podcast. Thanks for listening, guys, and hope you enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But to Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3. 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show, episode 125.
Interview with Gareth Powell. Can a cigar-chomping, one-eyed monkey really save the world?
That's a question, so somebody should answer that.
You'll have to read the book to find out.
Good answer. So, we have with us Gareth Powell, if that's not already obvious. He is the author of Ack-Ack Macaque, which I could only describe as having the coolest book cover in the last 20 years, because it's got a cigar-smoking giant monkey on the front who flies Spitfires and other kinds of flying vehicles and carries six-shooters and is a badass. I mean, that basically describes it, right?
Yep, that's pretty much covers everything there. Right?
So, just to start with quick thing, there will be some questions that have minor spoilers, so if people don't want to, like, by minor spoilers I mean like things that happen in the first 50 pages, but beyond that we're not spoiling anything beyond that. But if you're someone that like will get really angry if we tell you something that happens on page 2, now would be a time to pause and come back after you've read the book, which you should read anyway. But
yes,
so the first question I want to ask is just a general question, and that is, what drew you into writing in general, and then why did you sort of gravitate towards genre fiction?
I don't really know what drew me in, because it's something I've always wanted to do. I can remember very clearly being 7, 8 years old and writing stories with titles like The Knight and the Dragon Egg, or the Death Trap, and which were very short, you know, about 5 paragraphs, which was an epic in those days, and sort of drawing pictures to go with them and folding them in half and calling them books. So it's something I've always done. I think when I was about 13, my parents brought me my first portable typewriter and battered out some sort of fairly derivative Larry Niven-esque short stories. And it's I've always wanted to do it. I did a creative writing course at university, where what I learned was, don't listen to creative writing teachers, because the guy I had, I won't name him, but he was a poet. He was violently opposed to science fiction, wouldn't workshop it at all, and wanted everyone basically just to write poems like Seamus Heaney. So rather than a creative writing course, it was a 3-year Seamus Heaney appreciation course. So I started really writing genre fiction very seriously to sort of spite him, and sort of doing the opposite of everything he told me to do.
And clearly it's working out.
Yeah, it seems to work there, but it was only at the turn of the millennium, where I was 30 years old. It was the whole new 1,000 years rocking around. I thought, well, you know, if there's a time to get serious about something, it's now. So that's when I really sort of decided, let's go for it. And I wrote my first novel, Silver Sands, and then wrote a bunch of short stories and gradually got published. And that's, you know, it snowballed from there. But yeah, that was the moment I decided to really go for it.
That's awesome. So you are among many who had a bad creative writing course experience as a genre writer. So I have a friend who's also in college, and she's taking a creative writing class. And I think on the first day of classes, the teacher basically told them that genre fiction isn't literature.
Yeah.
Which is a problem already. So, but in any case, so Paul, you have your first question, I think, is the next one that's up, which is actually about writing itself.
Yeah, in some of your works, Gareth, you have a tendency to split the narrative between divergent time periods, like in The Recollection and now in Ack Ack Macaque, although you put a twist on that in the newest novel. What's your inspiration for doing this?
You mean that it alternates chapters between different storylines and different times?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in general, there's often a time jump between spots of your narrative in both works.
Yeah. I hadn't really noticed the connection before. With The Recollection, the sort of the difference in the time periods, it starts off in modern day London, and there's two strands, the other one 400 years in the future, was that I wanted to write a space opera, but I'd just written a lot of near future modern day short stories, and I wanted to try and take the sensibility of a modern person and use that as a pair of eyes to explore this space opera setting. So the modern day character could take the reader, and you'd experience the setting and the universe through their eyes. So it would be like a guide and something that people who maybe hadn't read a lot of space opera could relate to at least one of the characters. That was the idea. The switching backwards and forwards between characters in alternating chapters stops me getting bored, but also hopefully stops the reader getting bored as well, and it propels the story onwards. So you can end on a cliffhanger, switch to the next character, end them on a cliffhanger, switch to the next character, and that's why the book races through so quickly, I think.
I see. It does have that back and forth like a ping pong table, never letting you get stuck in one particular viewpoint and think like, oh god, when is this, when I'm going to look at something else.
The real thing you have to work hard to avoid there is you have to make both stories equally interesting, because there's nothing worse than reading a book where there's two plot strands and one you're completely compelled by and the other one is a bit dull, because then you end up skipping pages and, you know, just trying to get back to the good bit. So I had to be very careful to kind of, and to thematically link both strands as well. So when there's a lot of danger going on in one strand, I have to bring in some danger and some conflict in the other strand as well, and just kind of the mood makes a match between the two. So it's a smooth ride. It isn't a very sort of abrupt jump from peril and danger to not much happening to peril and danger, because that would break the mood and it wouldn't be quite a smooth read. So I had to sort of weave the two in very, very carefully so that they complemented each other. In other words, sort of like two jazz musicians like Miles Davis and John Coltrane, you know, riffing together. They're playing off each other rather than kind of trying to contrast with each other.
Or trying to outdo each other, right?
Yeah.
They're right. You've mentioned your musical tastes and interests and inspirations in the previous episode where you were discussing with in our discussion episodes. Yeah, so I can definitely see that now that you're thinking about that. I think you're up next, Sean.
Well, actually, a question related to this was not so much a question, just an observation, is I've not read your other work, so you'll have to excuse me for not having the encyclopedic knowledge of Paul, who is clearly your stalker and has just been following you online forever.
Oh, it's him, is it?
Yeah, it's him. but one thing I did notice with the way that the narratives are split here is that, yes, you have essentially like three different storylines, but what's really interesting about them is not just their internal stories, but actually figuring out how all of them connect together. And some of them start to connect fairly early, and others, it's not apparent immediately yet, other than maybe technological connections. But I do find that really interesting with the way that the narrative starts to, the pieces kind of come together, and you realize like, well, if we're switching to a new viewpoint, that's because we're now getting another piece of the puzzle, even though we're reading a different narrative.
We're talking about the Monkey Book now.
Ack Ack Macaque. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's very much. I had I very much wanted three characters there because I thought there were three implications to the technology and the world I was using, and to the political setup I was using, that I needed three different viewpoints in three different directions to kind of get a whole view of the world and of the sort of political shenanigans going on behind that. So that's why I got those three characters. But also, as the book developed, I found more and more links between those three characters, and at the end, or towards the end, without spoiling anything, but they realize a very strong commonality between them because of technology and various experiences they've had. So from that point of view, yes, I did set out to have those three and to have them come together, but they came together much more strongly than I was expecting.
Well, I really enjoyed it. I liked realizing that I wasn't reading three disparate stories and that suddenly all these little things were falling into place. So it was a lot of fun. But related to kind of actually the ways in which these are connected, one of your sort of storylines is actually Akak Makaku, who is the main figure on the cover. He's your monkey, and of course you do have your like weird monkey creature which you jiggle and it makes noise somewhere nearby, I'm sure. He'll make noise later, right?
I was trying to keep him out of the way.
But, yeah. But the world in which he lives is an alternate history in which essentially France and – or well, it's an alternate history of World War II, in which it's essentially like World War II on steroids, I guess you would say. Germany has ninjas who like paratroop in and like fight with ninja stars. They have tripods, there's nifty kinds of new technology. And one of the other interesting things that you have going on outside of that is the political union between France and Britain, which is set up on the very first sort of like a historical page at the start that kind of talks about this union. It's this kind of nifty what-if scenario. So I'm really curious, and this is technically I'm stealing from Paul in this, do you read much alternate history? And what sort of stuff do you maybe take cues from or enjoy?
I wouldn't say I've read an awful lot of alternate history, to be honest, beyond sort of books like Pavane and John Courtney Grimwood's Arabesque series, which is set in an alternate Alexandria.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah, that's incredibly good books. But I haven't read an awful lot, so I had a slight trepidation about writing in one, and did a lot of research, and a friend of mine called Justin made me kind of sit back and kind of think through the implications of if I change this, then I have to think through all the implications of what might happen down the road. I can't just, to use a technological analogy, it's like saying, writing a book set in the Middle Ages and then saying, these dwarfs have a knowledge of metallurgy and they've invented a howitzer. because that would have profound effects a few years down the line when everybody's got them. So you have to think through. So I did quite a lot of that. And the setup I used for the part of the story that's set in 2059 with the merged England and France, that's based on a real approach. France in the 50s, Guy Mollet, the French prime minister, really did come to England and propose a political merger between England and France, and was eventually turned down.
Whoa.
By Anthony Eden. And that's, that bit of the story is absolutely true. He did come. France was in trouble economically. They were facing all sorts of problems at home with their empire disintegrating. The Suez Crisis was building. England had been an ally during the war, and it seemed to make sense to sort of get some sort of Commonwealth agreement between the two countries. And they even proposed having Queen Elizabeth as head of the French state, which probably would have gone down like a lead balloon with the voters in France, reintroducing a monarch after so many hundred years of after slicing the heads off the last lot. But fortunately or unfortunately, it he was turned down. The Suez Crisis went a bit sour, created a rift between England and the USA and France. And then France got closer to Germany, and the European Union was founded between Berlin and Paris rather than between, as in my book, Paris and London. So it changed, you know, quite severely changed the political makeup of Europe. The only difference I made in my book was that the Suez Crisis, instead of being a military failure, was a military success. And that persuaded the British to go, you know, to merge with France. And that's how the world changed. It's you know, a very slight, you know, battlefield reversal, and everything's a bit different. And that, obviously, I wanted an alternate universe because I wanted Zeppelins. And, you know, and I could put the tech in that we haven't got, so I could put the tech in, but still not make it too far future, because I wanted it quite a near future, quite a near future thriller feel to it. But I didn't want to set it in the far future, so having an alternate universe allowed me to play about with a few things and add in a few things a bit different. And also it gave me a great excuse if I got any particularly telling details about Paris or anything wrong. I'll go, wow, in this universe they did build it that way. So
I'm so fascinated by the fact that this idea, because originally I thought, oh, well, this is kind of like a cute little, kind of almost a fantastical fantasy idea for an alternate history. And then you telling me that actually in history that there was an attempt to make this happen. Now I'm like infinitely more fascinated by this.
apparently there were more than one attempt, but that was the main one. I think there was, I remember reading it came out a couple of years ago. I think it was under what's, I think it's freedom of information, that certain things get declassified in this country after so many years. And that just popped out one of them. I think if you do a Google search, I think there's a report on it on the Guardian website somewhere. And I just, you know, it just stuck in my head, and I just thought, that's fascinating. So, you know, how would things be different? And I think that's the germ of any story, really. You look at things and go, if you change something, well, how would that be different? And it just took off from there. So when I needed an alternate setting, that was the one that popped straight into my head.
That's so cool. This is... There were lots of little, actually, historical tidbits that I noticed. I mean, there's a point at which you mentioned the tunnel, the big one that goes underneath the channel. And I didn't realize, and I didn't get to do too much research, but I didn't realize that how recent that was. But yet also, when I looked at the history, realizing how far back they were talking about it. As early as the 1850s, I think, is when the first serious proposals were being thought of. And the guy who actually discovered it went and did his own dangerous solo dives back when they didn't have good equipment to figure out what the seabed was made out of. And he's just like diving in the water. I'm like, this is so cool. Just the things that I'm discovering. And one of the things that I also found really amusing, stop attacking me, cat. That's over with that. One of the things that I loved was in the world with Akek Macaque, there's this amusing moment when he's just barely limped back alive in his plane, and it's blown up, and he's going to get a drink, and he tells the guy to go get him some bananas, and then the guy comes back, you know, and he's like, well, it's a war on, we couldn't get you any bananas. And I find it amusing because on the one hand, it's, you know, that the kind of cliche monkeys eat bananas, but on the other hand, it's actually a reference to what actually did happen in England. Bananas were basically impossible to get, so they were almost non-existent. And one of the interesting things that happened was after the war ended, all of these children who had essentially been raised in the war period suddenly saw bananas for the first time when they got the first shipments in. And it became a whole news story of children essentially being given these weird yellow things and saying, here, eat it. And they're like, I don't know. What do I do with this? It's a banana. So I did really enjoy these kinds of random historical facts. And I'm curious, how much, like, did you do a lot of research or what was your process for kind of weaving these little historical details in?
I did some research. I talked to people who've flown Spitfires. I've since got the Spitfire Handbook from the Air Ministry, and you know, so I kind of I didn't want to go into great big enormous boring detail, because when you, at the end of the day, it's a monkey flying the plane. So if the audience have suspended their disbelief that hard, then, you know, they're not going to be put off if I put too many rivets on the dashboard or something. But I wanted to make it, you know, just to get the feel, so it was, you know, I could, convincing, you know. So I did do some research, but I had the actual war itself is obviously because the world Akak Makak is in, which isn't the world he thinks he's in, and it certainly isn't our world, the I could take liberties with the war. And so what I did was I grew up as a child in England, there were all sorts of comics for boys with names like Commando, and they were all about rough, tough guys in the Second World War going out kicking Nazi butt, and you know, that was it. And they had fantastic adventures and things that never even happened in the Second World War were in there. You know, they'd have these attack helicopters and things, and you think historically that's a bit iffy. But so I thought, well, if I'm going to go for the comic book feel for these early wartime sections with the monkey, I'm just, you know, I'm just going to throw everything in it. So I've got Martian war tripods, I've got ninjas, the whole lot. It's just, why not? We've got a smoking monkey. Let's just, you know, we're sitting on the horse with the rope around our neck. Let's just whip it. So poof, off we went. And yeah, I think it really, chucking all that fantastic stuff in there just heightens the cartoonish element of those early chapters, I think, so that the later revelations become, you know, everything makes a bit more sense. Because I already had the 2059 in an alternate world. I didn't want to make the monkey's world just another alternate world, because then the reader might be trying to distinguish between the two, which one's the more believable. So I wanted to make the monkey's world cartoonish, in your face, bright, badam, just like those sort of British 1970s war comics.
That's so much fun. Just weird stuff just that you find in comics, I guess.
Yeah, one of the things that I was brought in mind of when reading those sections was the role-playing game, actually, Spirit of the Century, which has over-the-top zeppelins. It had all sorts of weird stuff going on around the world. Have you played any role-playing games, Gareth? Have you heard of Spirit of the Century? It's a thing that came immediately to mind before I cracked open Akak Makak and I first saw that cover. Like, oh my god, it's a Spirit of the Century sort of feel. And those over-the-top with the ninjas and tripods, everything else, is like, it felt like you had borrowed at least inspiration from the role-playing game, at least in spirit, maybe from the same sources.
I've not actually heard of that one. I sounds like I'm gonna have to dig it out and have a look. But no, I played Warhammer and Traveller RPGs as a teenager back in the 80s, but I've not really role-played since then. So.
Well, just so you know, apparently at certain conventions, there will be giant D&D sessions between authors.
All right.
Okay. So you may get swept in.
Yeah, the convention's coming up. Well, as of the recording of this, next week, there's going to be a big D&D session at a convention in Michigan.
With authors?
With authors.
Oh, my goodness. Apparently they had like 15, was it last year?
Yeah.
Or the year before, something like that. Yeah, there were like 15 authors playing D&D, and there were like long write-ups about it. So it sounds fun. But
it happens.
But in any case, so continuing on here, actually related to kind of the World War II theme and dealing with the monkey, I actually had this hilarious kind of feeling like I had been tricked, because I didn't actually read the description of the of the book. I made lots of assumptions about the cover and kind of the discussions we'd had when little details would be spoken about. So I thought originally this whole book was going to be just about a talking monkey shooting Nazis who has cigars, etc. But then it turns out that we're reading about a talking monkey shooting Nazis who happens to be a sentient being in the future as part of a video game. And there's even more details that come after that, which I'm not going to say anything about, because you have to get to that point for the more surprises. It gets more and more surprising. And what I was really curious about is what kind of drew you to, you know, you weren't just going to write a kind of comical book maybe about a talking monkey with cigars and kind of cutesiness, and which would be a fun book on its own. But now this kind of book, which has this subtext of, well, what do we do with sentient beings who are being essentially used in video games for our entertainment? So what kind of what drew you to this? Where did you get the idea, that kind of thing?
It started off, I think I wrote a short story back in 2006, 2007, called Akak Macaque, which was published in Interzone. And it kind of dealt with these issues in a slightly different way. It was about a relationship between a boy and a girl, and she's got a web cartoon series, and they make her eventually. The monkey becomes sentient and tries to take over the world by shooting down Lufthansa planes and so on. and they realize they've created the AI monkey that eats the internet, and that's basically what happens. And, you know, the story got a lot of attention, and I came first in the reader's poll for that year for favorite short story. And I always thought I kind of wanted to do more with that character. But so I was working on like an alternate history, sort of fairly noir murder mystery plot idea, and somehow the monkey wormed his way in there, because I mean, the mystery I had, and you know one strand of this book is a sort of, it starts with a murder, chapter one, there's a murder, there's somebody investigating it, and it goes from there. So. But that wasn't quite enough, and I think you have to kind of smash ideas together. So one idea is never enough. So I needed something else to go with that mystery. And when Solaris asked if I wanted to write the book, I kind of looked around, and the monkey was sitting behind me, looking at his fingernails, going, "About time too. I knew you'd be back.
Right.
What are we going to do?" And so. And it all just gelled. It's you take bits from all sorts of different inspirations and sort of slam them all together into and suddenly a plot sort of erupts out of it. So it's like making a cake, I guess. You chuck in eggs, you chuck in sugar, you chuck in raisins, chuck in whatever else you got in the cupboard, and you've got a cake. So it's that kind of process.
And now I want cake.
Cake.
God, thanks a lot, man. Thanks a lot. I would love some cake. So it's kind of you started with this short story, which has clearly a related elements, but a very different kind of plot point, since obviously this Akak Macaque has not tried to eat the whole internet.
No.
Yet.
Yet.
Who knows?
There is a sequel underway as we speak.
Oh, awesome, awesome. So, but at the same time, right, so you're kind of taking all these little pieces and kind of trying to mash them together to create this very what I guess you would say starts as a kind of a noir murder mystery set in the near future to what becomes a different kind of, I guess, a noir mystery, almost like a cyberpunk noir mystery with the kind of mysteries over Akak Macaque and where does he come from, etc., and so on, and kind of these elements kind of, I think, work together, and all three of the plot lines in some way are asking us the very serious questions about what it even means to be human, or for that matter, what it means to be a sentient living being. I mean, for example, Akak Macaque's world, the virtual world in which he is essentially a sentient actor, the way that world functions is he's essentially the centerpiece, and people come in and play the game in a kind of virtual reality and interact with him. And yet that in itself is already challenging. Well, okay, if you're engaging literally with a sentient living being, I mean, what does that tell us about ourselves, about what makes us human if we're actually capable of having a conversation with this monkey and he's has his own thoughts? And that's one of the kind of big shocking moments for him, is the moment when he realizes he can't die for whatever reason in the world he's living in. He can't die. And I don't know, I'm just kind of rambling, but I'm really curious about this question about sort of human nature or intelligent sentience. Nature, sentience, those kinds of questions. And those kind of are brought up in this book. And I don't know if you wanted to sort of speak to that at all, but.
Yeah. Well, the three main characters, you have the monkey, you have Victoria Valois, who's suffered a head injury and has had half her brain replaced by artificial processors. And then you have the Prince of Wales, Merivec, who obviously has certain revelations later in the book as well. So all three of these characters, they all start off, although they start off from different social statuses. Obviously, one's a prince of the realm, the other one's an ex-journalist who can no longer write because of the effects of this head injury she's had, and you've got a monkey who thinks he's a Spitfire pilot. All three of them, as I say, they gravitate together and they discover a commonality, which was none of them are who they thought they were, and all of them are to some extent artificial, and it's they have to come to terms with that, and they come to terms with it in very different ways. But at the end of it, there's a big crucible at the end of conflict, and they all come out of it in different ways, having come, I think, hopefully, to a kind of peace with it. And it is that question of is a woman with half her brain running on computer any less artificial than a monkey who's been upgraded to human intelligence by implanting him with artificial computer processing power? So and I think there's one thing I wasn't expecting with this book was the relationship between Victoria and the monkey, which very immediately becomes one of mutual recognition and respect. And they both look at each other and see each other in each other's eyes. So yeah, it was that question of where is the line when you start to uplift monkeys or bolt computer processing power into human skulls? The lines become blurred, and the individuals, I think, are the ones that have to tell you what they are, because you can tell them, what they are, but they might not feel like that. So I think yeah, definitely coming at it from that point of view, it's not trying to look for an answer, but trying to see where the interesting shading is between the various states.
And on that particular issue, I mean, there's all kinds of gray. I mean, the discussions already being had are wondering whether or not some of us are even human anymore. Because you think of, I mean, there's prosthetics, there's genetic manipulation, some of which actually exist already in your world. Merivec, I'm saying his name wrong. The prince. This isn't a big reveal. I mean, it's in the first couple chapters. Essentially, his first chapter, you learn that he's had some genetic modifications done because he's of royal descent, and there are certain assumptions about royal blood that there are conditions that are inherited, etc., and they've gotten rid of those, or they assume they got rid of them. Who knows what's going to happen in 100 years? But right, but those kinds of things exist, and those questions are being asked now. What is human when we can change our own nature? Or for that matter, what is any individual life when we can change that at any point? I mean, is he still a monkey?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if he's a monkey.
Exactly.
Does it matter?
Well, that's a question too. Does it matter?
I think, without giving too much away at the end, he has, as I've already revealed that there's a sequel, but he has to come to terms with that, and he has to understand where he fits into the world. And one of the processes is he has to face himself quite literally in the world of the computer game. So from that point of view, from looking in the mirror, and that's what they say is you show a cat a mirror, and for 5 minutes it's spooked, and then it realizes that the cat in the glass isn't a threat and forgets about it. Whereas you show like a higher primate a mirror, or a human a mirror, and they start to understand that it's themselves. and it becomes much more, you know, it's, you know, they're able to visualize that that's themselves. So it's a case of what is human, does it matter, and if tinkering with our genetic makeup, what's more human than that? We're born tinkerers. We've tinkered with everything since we crawled off the savannah. We, you know, we've half tinkered the world to death so far. So it's there are no answers in this book as to where the line is drawn, but there are plenty of questions.
Yeah. And you're right, we are tinkerers. We tinker with everything. I mean, even our food we tinker with. Not necessarily in a bad way, mind, just like, you know, the cows that we eat are not the same cows that we originally found, right? They've been, over time, we've essentially changed them by the way we have chosen to use them, essentially. And so, I mean, like, a dairy cow now would never have existed the same way it would have, you know, 2,000 years ago or whenever we've, I don't know when we domesticated cows. I'm just babbling. But yeah, so it's a very interesting, there are lots of cool questions, and I love that. I love that in a book when I don't expect it and I get it, because that makes me happy, because then I get to think and have fun, because it's a monkey who, and also the cool, oh my god, the evil villain guy in the first couple holy cow, that is like, that's stuff you're not going to see on like Law and Order, like that's some brutal stuff. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that's probably what would happen if we got some of that technology. Yeah, people would do that to evade being, you know, caught out, etc. And I just think, like, gosh, technology is going to make crime so much different over time. So,
yeah, that's just an observation. I can see now why Gareth liked the arabesque novels by Grinwood, because there is. It's kind of like 21st century cyberpunky in Alexandria, and I can see where you might have been inspired with some of the technology in Akak Makak from some of the stuff that goes on in those three books.
I was just thinking. I don't think I took any direct inspiration, but it was more like a feel of it.
Right.
It was the feel that this could be done. Yeah, definitely.
Or going back to like George Alec Effinger, have you read his work?
No, I've not. No.
When Gravity Fails, and those are also kind of quasi street cyberpunky Middle East, I think, that Grimwood was inspired by. So a chain of inspiration of weird cyberpunky technology and being used for nefarious ends in some cases, as Sean pointed out. It's really good stuff.
I shall add that to my list of things to look at when we finish this interview as well. It's getting to be quite a long list now.
You're welcome.
Speaking of inspirations, jumping off to a different question, one of the things I liked in the novel were the interstitial elements, the blog posts, the newspapers that you fill in between chapters, help filling in the world and also commenting on, in some cases, the narrative from a slightly skewed angle. What was the inspiration and models that you used for those?
I'm not sure there was a definite inspiration. In my previous book, The Recollection, I had each solar system that the spaceships visit has its own kind of all-pervading data net. So every time a spaceship jumped into a new space system, I'd have a page with just the local headlines.
Right.
From the data net, was as the ship arrived, that's what it received. And I put in clues in those as to building up to what was going to happen in the second half of the book, which is this great big sort of intergalactic crisis. But you can see it, you know, clues building in these headlines through the first half of the book. And I quite enjoyed doing that. And so it kind of came naturally, because in Akak Makak, there is a mounting international crisis going on in the background all the way through the book, and it's all building up towards this huge kind of crisis that the villains want to exploit, and obviously everyone else wants to avoid. And the best way I thought to get that sense of a gradually building international crisis was by having the headlines. So I put these in, and then I thought I wanted to, because I wanted to talk about the video game Akak Makak as well. and rather than just kind of info dump, I thought I'll start sticking some blog posts from, like, so I invented this sort of technology blog called TechSnark, which is kind of like a Wired or a Boing Boing kind of clone, and wrote fake articles about the game from their point of view and stuck that in as well. So it was like, because at the moment a lot of the characters in there are very kind of are hackers, or they're very computer literate, and it's a very joined up world. It seemed to add to the experience to have you reading a narrative, but also you're checking out the headlines and the blog posts that feed into that narrative as well, or comment on it. So in some ways, a bit like a Greek chorus. So it's, at one point I was saying, you know, they've pulled the monkey out of the video game, and it's created an uproar amongst the online community, which by saying that once is, you know, it doesn't have a great deal of impact. But then when you see a blog post about it going, where's the sodding monkey? It's
yes.
It just gives you a glimpse into that world, and it reinforces it, makes it a bit more real, I think. I enjoyed doing it that way anyway. I have to say, in the sequel, there are no such. I haven't included them because it's a different situation and they're not needed, and to do it again would feel a bit gratuitous because there isn't a reason for them to be there yet. I think of one, I'll stick some in, but at the moment there aren't, so I didn't want it to become a...
affectation?
Exactly the word. I didn't want it to become an affectation of the series that they had to all have that in it. But when it's relevant, yes, definitely.
Cool. Paul, that one's yours.
Which one's mine?
The one that comes right after that. We're professionals, you can tell, Gareth. Yeah.
Well, Gareth is more or less answered this question.
That's true. Yeah.
I was going to ask you whether you've exercised that cigar chomping monkey out of your consciousness, but you've spoken a couple of times that you're writing the sequel, so obviously not. Akak Makak is still in your head.
Yeah, it's Solaris have commissioned a sequel now, based on the enormous buzz about the first book. So I'm a little way into writing that at the moment, and I've got a deadline of June to finish writing that and hand it in, and it should be published about this time next year in 2014. So
that's excellent. Awesome. That's really great. Yeah, and you had a weird publishing schedule, because I think it came out last year in one country got it before the other one.
Yeah, the according to my publisher, the official publication date is January the 3rd. And it did come out January the 3rd in the UK, but it's something strange to do with Christmas and supply chains and deliveries and whatnot that it had to be shipped and ready to go in America a couple of days before Christmas. And I think it kind of said it came out on Boxing Day or December 26th. I think you guys don't have Boxing Day, do you?
Nope.
State? No.
Okay. December the 26th, it came out the day after Christmas, which is ridiculous in some ways, because everyone's too busy being at home with a hangover and full of turkey to get down to the bookshop. But it was, so I was asking this of my publisher as I was going, so for, you know, according to this, it came out a week before and a week after, but that does that mean, you know, if anyone nominated it for an award, who would nominate a monkey book for an award? But anyway, which year would it be in? And they were saying, well, our official date is January the 3rd. So officially it came out in January 2013.
Yeah. Well, it's so strange. But
it's the mystery of the publishing world.
But at least they came out reasonably within the same time, because in movies that doesn't always happen. Like there's... oh God, what movie? I think it's Upside Down. One of the movies that's coming out next year that I'm looking, or this year that's coming out, it's already been released in like half of the countries last year from November through December, but here it's not being released until like February or March. And then like you had Cloud Atlas, which its US debut was last year in November, I think, but then isn't being released in the UK until February, even though it's based on a book by a British author. And it's so bizarre, and I don't understand it, but same thing, I guess.
Although, I have to say, that could be a good sign, because sometimes when they release movies simultaneously everywhere, it means they want everyone to go see it before the bad reviews start.
Oh, that's a good point.
Huh. I'm thinking of the Uma Thurman and Ralph Fiennes Avengers here.
Oh, God.
They released it worldwide simultaneously, with not having had any press screenings, so that really wasn't a good sign.
Sean yeah, Connery, we may have to watch that movie at some point, Paul.
Yeah, that would work for Torture Cinema, Sean Connery in a teddy bear outfit.
Oh,
but we're
God.
Digressing. We're digressing. Maybe we should do the fives.
Yeah, so all right, now. So I got five quick, silly questions for you, Gareth.
Okay.
You don't have to think too hard about these. It should be quick. But all right. So question number one is: would you rather be a talking monkey or an illegally acquired silicon-based intelligent floating squid?
I'll go for the monkey. I think squid. Yeah, but you're kind of dependent on living in an ocean. Whereas a monkey, you can get up to a bit more mischief.
That's a good point. All right. Number two: would you rather have a Tommy gun or a pair of six-shooters from the 1800s?
Ooh, I'll go for the six-shooters from the 1800s, just for the workmanship and the... always been a big Western fan. And Tommy Gunn's notoriously bad at jamming.
Good point. Very, very practical. They're thinking these through. All right, awesome. Number three, then, is would you fly on a Spitfire or an F-22 Raptor?
Spitfire every time. just to hear, if you've ever, I don't know if you've ever heard a Spitfire go over quite low, but the roar of that Rolls Royce Merlin engine is, you just can't beat it. That is one of the best sounds in the world.
All right, number four, if you knew you were going to be shot down and die in a super cool dogfight, what kind of drink would you like to be your last?
I don't know. If I'm going out with a bang, I think it would probably be a cocktail of rum, absinthe, whiskey. It'd be the entire drinks cabinet in a pint glass, I think.
I don't know if you would make it to the plane. You might die from poisoning.
Or the head hangover.
If you knew you were going to be shot down, what the hell? You know,
a fair point.
You're sat in the cockpit with a big crack pipe and a big bottle of rum, and fuck it, going down, might as well start smoking again.
Alright, number five. If Americans invaded England and subjugated your people to the tyranny of celebrity reality TV, would you mount an armed resistance?
Yes, but I'm afraid we're already ankle deep in reality TV shows over here anyway, with we get all yours on repeat as it is. So I don't think you need to come over here in the landing craft. You've already invaded the schedules. So yes, I'd like one day. I'd like a reality show that's actually about reality as well.
Yeah, no, that's never going to happen.
No,
I'm sorry.
But as a writer, employ more script writers, less reality, more escapism.
Amen. Well,
yeah, that works. All right, so our final two quickie questions, those were the questions five, the silly questions, but these are just so people can know more about you. Okay. You've mentioned you've got, in theory at least, hopefully, assuming there are no hurdles like Solaris goes bankrupt or something. It's not going to, because Solaris is awesome. But we know you have the next book in this particular series, the Akak Makak series, in theory will be coming out around this time next year. Yep. But what other work should we expect from you in, say, the next 12 months?
I don't know about 12 months because of the timings and everything, but I have written over Christmas 10 chapters of a brand new space opera novel.
Ooh, nice.
And also blocked out a big outline for an urban fantasy novel set in the 1950s. So... both of those are with my agent at the moment, so hopefully something will come of both of them. At the moment, I've had a few short stories out last year, but this year it's pretty much the table's clear, and I've got 5 months to get this second monkey book written and delivered, so it's going to be head down and all guns on that until June, and then hopefully by then one of those other two books I mentioned may have picked up some interest, and I'll have something to fire into for the second half of the year.
Awesome. What is my cat is, I don't know, understand my cat, he's so weird. Sorry, there's a little bit of noise. Cool, so maybe not anything coming out this year, but certainly we should be expecting novels from you for a long, long time, because it seems like you're really working on a lot of stuff here, so that's awesome. So the next question is, where can folks find you? So, you know, like your online presence, and if you have any maybe convention plans or something like that at some point in the next year.
You can. My website is www.garethlpowell.com, and from there you'll find links to my Twitter and my Facebook. I'm on both of those. I'm on Twitter probably more often than I should be, seeing as I should be writing. As for conventions, the beginning of February, I'm doing something at the British Space Museum with another author called Kim Lakin-Smith and an editor and author called Ian Waits. We're doing some workshops and discussion panels and things for the public there as part of their kind of season of space and fiction event that they're doing up there. End of February, I'm on the bill for the Sci-Fi Weekender in North Wales, which is a big media event. There'll be a couple of Doctor Who's there and Brian Blessed and a few people like that. I don't know what I'll be doing there, but I'm on the bill. End of February, EasterCon in Bradford, the British Science Fiction Association's annual convention, which is every Easter. And then October, later in the year, BristolCon in Bristol, funnily enough, and World Fantasy Con, which is in Brighton in the UK this year. So
that's awesome.
I'll be there as well. So yeah, I'll be out and about, and probably, you know, a few other places as well.
And then next year, if I recall correctly, WorldCon is going to be in England. Is it in London?
That's right, London in 2014. Yes. So I believe they're using the Olympic Stadium. So
oh, cool.
No, they're not. No.
you just made that up.
Made that up, yeah. You all have to run 800 meters. So, but yeah, no, so that'd be great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well. So you've got World Fantasy Con this year and then World Con the year after. So yeah, UK, it's time to shine, I think.
And it may be possible that I will be there, but I can't guarantee that. That depends on certain research funding.
Way too soon to tell.
Yeah, I have to pass my exams first.
Well, if you make it, we'll definitely have a beer.
Awesome. That's awesome. So awesome. So thank you so much for coming on the show and talking with us, Gareth. It was really awesome.
Anytime. Yeah.
Cool. So everybody should go check out Akak Macaque. It's, I mean, if you buy books, you know where to buy it. So go buy it. Also, just a random bit of historical fact. Apparently, certain people in Britain's leadership are considering another Falklands War. So, according to RT.com, which I guess is Russian, so we can't trust it because they're commies. But but there you go. So, thanks again, Gareth, and we'll see everybody else on the flip side.
Cheers.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.